Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is an old friend who was anonymous when we last interviewed him for The Paris Architect. Now he's a bestseller, well-known. His book has been translated into Italian, Hungarian, Turkish, Portuguese, Bulgarian, and no doubt optioned for a movie. Of course, that book is The Paris Architect. It was one of our book club picks in our bookshop, and we had a great discussion about it. The thing is that Charles, I don't think, ever expected this, and I would normally be saying of an author that he was the graduate of some prestigious college with an MFA in literature and had attended the Iowa Writers' Workshop, but that wouldn't be true, and as Charles said, he's not really comfortable in that kind of setting. He has no creative writing training as such, and he likes writing fiction because it's kind of easier than the hard work of architecture. However, architecture figures strongly as a veritable protagonist in his work, and his latest novel, The House of Thieves, or House of Thieves, is no exception. Here, we have a semi-aristocratic family, each of whom is discreet in the sense of being singular, almost as if they were structures themselves, with all of the nooks and crannies, ornate design, and Gothic or postmodern or neoclassical elements, including a gargoyle here and there. So John Cross is a successful architect. His beautiful wife is Helen. Their marriage is tottering a bit, but they move on through the social demands of the 1860s, a plethora of parties, and a guidebook of social decorum that they must adhere to. Their children are George, who has some severe gambling problems that escalate until they form the nexus of the plot of the novel. Julia, their daughter, another beauty, like Helen, is preparing to become the city's most eligible debutante, and young Charles, a scamp, as well as the others, figure into the rather intricate plotline of the book. Each character surprises with detours in their life of strict and straight avenues of decorum, within which a hint of scandal must never be seen. But scandal there is, and plenty of it. Suffice it to say that the story enthralls and is best read in one sitting, just as I read The Paris Architect. Architecture features and fits inextricably in Charles's work. And he creates, no pun intended, a superstructure from which we can build a building, a family, and a story. So with that, welcome, Charles, and thanks so much for joining us again here today.
Thanks for inviting me to your show.
You're welcome. So why the time and the place in this book? You chose it last time to be Nazi Germany during the war. So why this time and place? Why Carolyn Astor? How much did real events of the time and real buildings of the time influence you in the writing of this book?
Well, this was my favorite time period in history, the Gilded Age of New York in the late 19th century, the 1880s and the 1890s. And it was also my favorite period of architecture. And I went to school in New York, and so I was really familiar with all the buildings that still survived from that time period. So I'd always been interested in that particular time period. So I wanted to do a novel in that setting, in that time period.
And one of the things you did was you took Miss Astor and you put her as, not, I wouldn't say pivotal, but you put her as a driving force in the novel as to how she could place people in society and also kick them out of society. Did you research that, or did you know it already, or how'd that work out?
Well, I knew a little bit about it, but then I had to do a lot of research on the time period of high society and reading social etiquette guides, you know, like how many forks are at the dinner table or how many wine glasses, that type of thing. And then also the strict code that they have to live by. And if they got gossiped about or any kind of scandal, it was surprising that these people who were very, very wealthy could be just cast out of society. So that fascinated me.
And that period of time also fascinates me, too. And I'm going to be in New York day after tomorrow, and I'll be walking up Fifth Avenue, and I'll be seeing much of what were the homes of the richest families in America, whether it's the Palace and the Plaza or Bergdorf's. And I'm fascinated by all those stories because you look at these now retail establishments, and you don't realize that at one time these were the places that housed the people that moved America, right? And there's also all kinds of stories, too, about why they built the homes they built, why the plaza, the statue in the plaza, faces the way it faces. It's just replete with all kinds of the architecture is full of the stories of these people's lives, don't you think?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story.
How did you decide, once again, well, I guess I know, having an architect whose knowledge of the craft forming a big part of the book?
When I was researching the Gilded Age in New York, and I was just looking through various general references, I stumbled across a real historical figure named George Leslie, who had come from a wealthy family in the Midwest to practice architecture in New York City. And this was in the late 1860s, early 1870s. And so he practiced for a while, but then he decided to give up practicing architect and become a criminal and plan bank robberies, because it was far more lucrative than being an architect. But most importantly, it was far more exciting to be a bank robber and to plan these robberies. And he enjoyed associating with these lowlifes and sociopaths of the Lower East Side in New York City, you know, as opposed to the society people that he still associated with. He led a dual life, you know, still rubbing shoulders with the rich, but he made his living, you know, planning and carrying out robberies with these dregs of society in the Lower East Side. And he liked being around these guys.
It's funny, you know, James Kent, who is that guy, he's a dastardly fellow. But once again, his facade, architecturally, is that of a gentleman. But he really, this guy stops at nothing and does some really horrible, horrible things. You know, and some of those horrible things were like kind of the things that happened in The Paris Architect, too, actually. So there's one at the beginning with the icebox that's scared the heck out of me. And then there's one at the end, which is kind of shocking. So you're just a regular guy, but you come up with some really nasty stuff both in both books. Where does that come from?
Well, it's interesting how people can lead sort of a normal, respectable life. And then on the other hand, in their character, they're capable of being total sociopaths who, don't care about, you know, taking other people's lives or hurting other people. So that always fascinated me, that people had one side to them. And in this case, Kent was from a wealthy family, and he had been trained to be a doctor. And he fell into the criminal world, and he really loved it. And so, and he was a family man. But on his other side, he had no hesitation in killing somebody. So that fascinated me.
Yeah, it's almost as if in some situations people kind of have a breaking point, and that's when they break through the thin veneer of civilization that we live in. But what you describe are people who don't even they're amoral rather than immoral. He's just following the path of expediency in doing the horrible things he does. Which is fascinating. So, real quick, tell about your own encounter with organized crime that in part gave you the motivation for this book.
Well, besides coming across this figure named George Leslie, I had thought about the underworld or the mob before as a possible subject for a book. When I was a young man in the late 1980s in Connecticut, I had inadvertently taken on a small job doing an addition to a house, a very modest suburban house. But during the course of the project, I found out it belonged to an underboss of the New England mafia, and so that scared me. But I had no place to complain to, or I couldn't walk away from the job. So I just stuck it out, and I got along with the guy. He was putting this addition onto this house where he lived, and he was going to give it over to his son, and he was going to move into an apartment. And so he still lived in the house, and he was there every day on the construction site, you know, screaming at contractors and telling people what to do. And I would come over periodically to inspect the work and, you know, discuss things with him. And he was always a very nice guy to me. And the project went on, and it was completed. And then about 2 or 3 weeks after the thing was finally complete, I was walking past a newspaper kiosk, and I saw his face on the cover of the newspaper, and it was his mugshot from when he was in prison. And it turned out that he had been murdered, and his body had been stripped and thrown into the river. And later on, it turned out that his crew, they hated him because he had such a terrible temper. He really wasn't a people person. He didn't have good management skills, and so they got sick of him, and they had gotten, you know, the okay from other factions within the New England Mafia to, you know, get rid of him. So they just took him out one night on some pretense, and then they shot him in the back of the head. So, but I got along with the guy really well. He was a very friendly guy. I didn't have to work with him in that capacity. So I'd always thought of doing some sort of book based on that situation. And then when I found this other historical character, it sort of came together about what it would be like, you know, to be in the underworld. So those two influences gave me the idea for the book.
Did you get paid for the Did you get paid for the job?
I'm sorry?
Did you get paid for the work you did? Did he die after?
Oh, yes. They're very, very good businessmen. I mean, you deliver a service, you get paid right away. There's no waiting months for a check or anything. They're very, very sharp, astute businessmen, you know, who pay their bills.
Yeah. Hey, so I was thinking, the youngest child, Charles, your name, is he modeled after you? Because he is kind of a scamp and kind of ungovernable.
Yeah, when I was developing that character, I liked the idea that his son Charlie had just left in the morning the house, and he would just wander all over the city, you know, and, you know, get into all kinds of mischief, and then finally he meets, you know, a child who's a petty criminal. And I thought that was very interesting. And then he would just come home at night and, you know, have supper and come back to his privileged world there. So I like that whole idea that he was out the whole day engaging in petty crime or doing other things. So, you know, I like that because I used to go out in the summers in the morning and, you know, not come back until dinner time, which is quite different today. Parents put GPS devices on their children to know where they are. So I like the idea of him just wandering the city.
What do you think about, like, some of the reviews? I mean, the reviews are glowing, but some of the reviews say, wow, isn't it far-fetched that you got John, Helen, George, Julia, Charles, who all, without giving anything away, although the reviews tell a lot, so I don't feel like I'm spoiling anything, it's kind of far-fetched that all five of them would kind of switch and be semi-comfortable in moving from this one arena, societal arena, into this other societal arena.
I wanted all of them to have secret lives. And when I'm writing fiction, I usually don't care if I'm going over the top or if it's too far-fetched, because it's such a pleasure for me to write, as opposed to being an architect where I have to deal with building codes and green building codes and budgets and everything. So I just let my imagination go, and then, you know, sometimes it goes, you know, over the top, but I don't care.
Yeah, well, it's like your idols, like Thomas Hardy, who was an architect, and Wallace Stevens and Somerset Maugham, who worked kind of moonlighted like you do. And Dickens was about as far-fetched as you could get, and this book is kind of Dickensian in that sense, you know, like the street urchin who meets another, or the little prince who meets the street urchin and end up being best buddies, and the ratting and all the different.
Yeah, it has a Dickensian tone to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I admire his writing, and then he puts people in these different situations where they meet people they normally would never meet in their whole lives. So that sets up the whole dynamic of the novel.
Plus, it's fun because you stick opium dens in there and all kinds of different things that you wouldn't expect to find. And that's quite humorous, the way her chaperone doesn't realize what she's getting herself into, but is happy as can be, because it's like she's, you know, takes care of her lumbago or something. That was a great idea, too. And a great device to get away from. Well, you know, if you take Julia escapes into this, kind a romance with this gentleman, and then Charlie meets this buddy who's saves him from a situation, and then his wife Helen, like I said at the beginning, their marriage is, you know, they don't, it's a kind of a loveless marriage, but at the end, and I won't give this away, the whole dynamic of their relationship changes, and it's almost like what they've been through is like a session of marriage counseling, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something brings them together.
Yeah, and it's like one of these old Pink Panther movies or something like that, where crime doesn't necessarily pay, and you don't say, I don't want to say too much, but the idea is that there can be a level of activity in a family, and they all join together in the end, knowing what the other one's doing. And it's kind of like, you know, there's no harm in it. They're all having a good time. Who knows what the eventual end of it will be. But while it's going on, they all seem to be much closer than they were when they were tied up in all these social mores, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was really well done. And the other thing is, once again, you know, one of my favorite parts of The Paris Architect is when he's looking around the room and looking at every aspect of it and trying to figure out, what can I do? Where can I hide this poor guy? And he hides him in the column. And the workmanship that's done is stunning. And so he's not found. And then you did the same kind of thing here. Talk a little bit about the house that you built. I'll say you. That has the moat around it and the little method of getting into that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, that was based on a real house that was used to be up on Fifth Avenue, just like you were talking about, how they used to be lined with the houses of the rich, and now it's basically apartment houses and businesses along Fifth Avenue. But, you would have a great mansion, and to keep the thing private from the public, you would have a waterless moat, this almost deep pit that goes around all four sides of the building, and the only way to get into the building is almost like a little drawbridge at the entry that's mechanically operated there. But you would have a gap of maybe, you know, 20 feet from the edge of the sidewalk to the face of the house. And that gave you privacy in the midst of the city.
How did you come up with like the denouement, or more like the climax of the book being at the Statue of Liberty? Did you think of that first, or did it come to your mind, hey, this is when the Statue of Liberty was being put up too? How'd you figure that out?
One of the things that I did for the research is that if you can go online, and the Library of Congress has historical newspapers online, you know, the entire run, you know, for free to look at.
Which is amazing.
So I decided to look at every issue of the New York Tribune for 1886. So I would start on January 1st and just go day by day just to see what life was like in New York at that period. You know, and the paper was only like 6 or 8 pages. It's not like today's papers. So then all of a sudden, when you got into October, they started talking about the unveiling of the the gift from France, the lady holding the torch. They didn't call it the Statue of Liberty then, but that was, and it became a really big deal because they raised the money for the pedestal out on the island in the bay, and they started, you know, erecting it, you know, over during the year. And so at the end of October, that was going to be the unveiling. And it was a really, really big event in New York City where schools closed down, businesses closed down. It was just a huge celebration. So they started reading about it, and they gave a really detailed account of it in the Tribune. They dedicated the entire issue, you know, that day's paper, to the event. So you had lots and lots of detail. So that's how I got the idea of staging a murder there.
Yeah, that was very well done. It was like, I didn't expect it. And like you say, it's something you kind of discover. And it happened to be a very interesting time in the history of the United States. There was a lot of money floating around. There was this society that was almost Victorian in a way, but at the same time, there was this underside, like you were talking about, like Kent wants to associate with these nefarious creatures, but there was a whole underside that was its own society. And how did you find more out about that? Like the ratting. Explain what the ratting was, and also what the dogs did too.
Yeah, ratting and cockfights were really popular pastimes of the poor in the criminal world. In ratting, you would actually, you know, collect rats from buildings and put them in an enclosed arena, and then you would have and they were usually terriers could be trained to kill rats, you know, grab them by the neck and break their necks. And so people bet on how many rats the dog could kill, let's say, within 15 minutes. And so it was a really big betting event. And so it was a really popular gambling pastime, you know, along with cockfights. And so, but these terriers had a natural ability to go after rats and kill them one by one with astonishing, you know, rapidity and ease. So that had fascinated me because I'd read a lot about the underworld in the Lower East Side of New York City, about all the different things they did, how they gambled, and, you know, what kind of card games they played. So I did a lot of research on the underworld, just like I did on high society.
Did kids actually go out, like Charlie and his buddy, did they actually go out and they used kids to bag the rats and then pay them as they came in? It sounds
right.
Like something.
That was a lot of kids did that because there were so many rats on the Lower East Side or in Manhattan. You know, you could herd them into by banging on floors. You could have another person holding a large sack and herd them in there. And they would just drag the bag full of rats, you know, to one of these gambling dens because they're always looking for rats because the dogs were constantly killing them. And so you could get, you know, 10, 12, 15 cents a rat, and that was an easy way to make money for these kids.
Oh, yeah, that reminded me, 15 or 20 cents. I was thinking, if George was in debt for $48,000, I was trying to figure out what that would be. He was in debt for an enormous amount of money, wasn't he?
Right, that would be like over $1 million today. I mean, he was hopelessly in the debt, you know, and the interest was piling up. And so what happens, you know, when you owe a debt to the underworld, there's no installment plan or forgiveness plan. You pay up or you die. You know, they don't show any mercy. You know, they can't let people off with debts because then other people will want, you know, forgiveness. So they kill people to, you know, to teach people a lesson about paying their debts.
Yeah, and it's like, how would, you know, I was thinking about you and the protagonist, and, you know, what would you, I mean, because you must have thought about this to a certain extent, But if you were John Cross and your son got into that kind of situation, would you go to the police? Would you tell him to take care of it himself? Would you do something like what John does? Have you ever thought about that?
Because when you're dealing with the underworld, okay, I mean, you go to the police, but that's not going to stop these people. These people live in their own kind of universe with their own rules, and so they can do anything they want. So going to the police is not going to help. So he was faced with a decision, John Cross, whether to cooperate with Kent and his gang and plan the robberies of the buildings he's designed or have his son killed. So, you know, no parent wants to see their son, their child murdered, so he just goes along with it because he has no choice. You know, he wants to save his son.
It's much like, again, in The Paris Architect, where the first time he does it, and his kind of mentor says, "Don't worry, I'll never ask you again." And each time he keeps saying, "No, don't worry, I'll never ask you again." And then at some point, just like it does with John, there comes a point where you go, "Wow, this is really interesting. This is a fascinating thing to do. Where can I find a place where I can hide him?" And John is like, "Okay, how am I going to figure out how to do this?" And they're both kind of sucked into it, not for nefarious reasons, but for almost like the intellectual aspect of it.
Right. That's exactly right. And there's the similarities in both cases. In Cross's case, he begins to enjoy the whole, job, planning these things. And he enjoys kind of the thrill of, being there and the possibility of getting caught. So, the conceit of the novel is that he's forced to do this, but then over time he begins to enjoy it. He enjoys being a criminal.
And I like the way towards the end of it, when he's really involved, he kind of starts ordering them around too, you know? It's like, "No, don't do it that way, do it this way."
Right. He really gets into it. He really, he's not scared anymore. He enjoys running the show and deciding on the targets to rob. And so it becomes a pleasure for him.
And I said it like not flippantly, because I mean you don't have to tell me or anything, but I'm assuming The Paris Architect would be a great movie. And you write I bet you it's because of the architecture aspect of your life. You write in a very cinematic way that the reader, especially like with Helen and Julia being so beautiful, you have this image in your mind of what they look like and their costuming. But this one could easily is almost storyboarded as a movie, and I can imagine it also turning into film, can't you?
Yeah. Back in September, a production group announced that they were optioning it. And I don't know whether it was going to be for a movie or for a television series, because all of a sudden, television, with Netflix and all these other venues have become very popular. So, so both of them have, the opportunity to be turned into movies or into a television series.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because The Paris Architect kind of has a real ending where, well, it's an ending, but it's still open-ended. But this is open-ended. I mean, you could have a second and a third season because they could keep doing their thing.
I don't know what the producer's intent is yet about House of Thieves, whether that would be just a series about up to the end of the book itself, or whether it continues or not. So I have to find out about that.
Well, I guess to end it up, kind of like, it seems like you really are, and you said it, you said this is fun for you. It's fun writing, which I don't really hear that a lot from authors, tell you the truth. But so it's fun because it's kind of an escape for you. You don't really care whether a reviewer says, "Hey, this could never happen, it's over the top," because it's something, authors can lie. You can lie, you can write anything you want. If people don't like it, they don't have to read it. But so do you anticipate continuing in this fashion? Do you can anticipate becoming an author who, like Agatha Christie or somebody else, writes about crime and has a protagonist? Do you like the idea of continuing to include architecture as a fundamental part of the plot of your books?
Yeah, for all the rest of the books that I'll do, I know that I'll include architecture as sort of a central basis of the plot. And so that's the one thing I know for sure. I mean, I don't think I'll develop a protagonist that, you know, appears in subsequent books. I think each one basically will stand by itself. But I'll continue to write because it's far less stressful than being an architect. I mean, even today, this morning, I had to deal with some small crisis, you know, in a building, and it was very stressful. But then I can go and sit in front of the computer in my basement and just make all this stuff up, you know, and no one tells me I can't do this, and can't do that, or it's too expensive, or it violates the building code. So I'll continue to write.
Yeah, it's funny because my family has been in the building business since like 1958, and when you're talking about green building, and we try to get all our buildings platinum LEED certified, and our architects strive for beauty, and every once in a while I go in there and I'll kind of yell at them because it's like sometimes it's function following form because they want it to be beautiful. It's very expensive, and but form following function doesn't necessarily create beauty.
Yeah, lots of architects create conflicts in that regard, exactly that regard, what you just described here. But you see, when you're writing the fiction, there's no one there next to you saying, well, that sentence is too expensive, or, you know, cut this paragraph because it's costing too much money, or that type of thing. It's a real, writing is a unilateral creative process. Architecture is a collaborative creative process because the design that the architect is doing, he's not paying for that out of his own pocket. Someone else is footing the bill for that. He has a client. And so the client has the right to veto creative decisions, whether because he just doesn't like them or it costs too much money. And that's a really big difference in writing as opposed to architecture, is that architecture is the ultimate collaborative process. Writing is a very solitary thing, and that's what makes it so great.
Yeah, you have a fascinating life. And what's interesting about it is what you said earlier, is that even though the two things are completely different, you can borrow from your skill, your intelligence, your history of design in creating a template for a book. You know, we were talking about superstructure and skeletons, and that's very interesting that you can borrow from one to create the other but still have the freedom you do.
Yes, I just draw on my experience and my imagination on this, and it's quite pleasurable.
That's great. Well, Charles, thanks as always. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon when you pen your next novel. So,
all right, I always enjoy talking to you. You ask a lot of good questions and everything. I really enjoy your interviews.
Thanks so much. That means a lot to me. So we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, right. Goodbye. Thanks
Bye-bye.
Again.
So that was a great interview with Charles Belfour. He said some kind things there about me at the end, which is always nice. The reason why I ask good questions is because he writes good books. And some of them might seem outlandish, but I like his answer. He doesn't care. He's writing the book, and if you don't like it, that's too bad. And if some of the reviewers go, oh, this would never happen in the real world, well, maybe it wouldn't. But the idea about writing and the idea about our bookstore is that, you know, you can hold these books and inside is a world. And it doesn't have to comport or comply with the rules that you have imposed upon you, like he says about his buildings. Yeah, he has to meet the codes. He has to come in under budget. He has to make sure that he finds a place for the mechanical room, that he puts things in places where he wish he didn't have to put them so he'd have more room to make it more beautiful, all those kinds of things. And when he writes, even though he uses that conceit, as he says, he's able to free himself from all those shackles. So as always, the Paris Architect, great book, and House of Thieves, I think you'll like just as much. I guess I'd read Paris Architect first. I guess I'd read them in the order, because if he's continuing, and will continue, and also I'd read them because they probably will go on Netflix or Amazon or Hulu or Crackle or one of those if they decide. And they will work very well as series because, like I said, they're storyboarded. You don't have to have someone tell you when you're making the movie, oh, we should go here or here. It's almost as if it's already planned out. And again, that goes back to his architectural background. So enough of that. Great guy. So join us every week. We are going to have our annual review of the favorite books that we have at the bookstore for 2015. And it's always nice when Donna, our manager, get together and banter about, sometimes briefly insulting each other, about our different picks of books. And you should look forward to that one because it'll be a lot of fun. And Rebecca, throughout this entire year, I want to thank her for her immense efforts at getting some of the best authors that exist. You know, these people who, and she has her eye and her hand on the pulse of these books that are not yet recognized for their greatness, but will be. And that's why I think I put in the past, you know, books like Gone Girl and Girl on a Train, that no one thought would be anything. George Saunders, The 10th of December, Rachel Kushner, The Flamethrowers. Lots and lots of books that, you know, they weren't on anybody's radar, but then they end up winning the Pulitzer Prize or the National Book Award. Hilary Mantel, Station 11, or, you know, all those books. So in any event, at this time of year, I really would like to thank Rebecca and Donna for all the work they've done. And I hope you continue to join us for the remainder of the year and our best books of 2015. And then we'll start out January of 2016, which I can't believe it is, with a whole new batch of great authors, great books here on the Avid Reader.